Jordan glanced unobtrusively around him. On every side, there were pale, frightened faces and wide, staring eyes. The court was terrified. Jordan badly wanted to ask Gawain or Heather what the hell the steward was talking about, but he didn't dare draw attention to himself with a display of ignorance.
You're the steward, Catriona. Do what you have to.
The courtiers stirred uncertainly and looked warily about them. In ones and twos, and then in groups, they started to edge away from each other. Jordan quickly became aware that even Gawain and Heather were doing it in what seemed to be an unconscious reaction. He let his hand rest casually on the sword at his side. Something was about to happen. Something awful. He could feel it in the air, a tense atmosphere that was thickening from anticipation into certainty. The steward looked slowly around her, her dark eyes cold and watchful.
Nobody is to interfere, whatever happens. I don't need distractions.
She glared about her, and the courtiers nodded dumbly. Catriona Taggart smiled grimly and raised a hand.
Reveal!
Jordan staggered back a step as reality shuddered around him, torn and sundered by the force of the steward's sorcery. He shook his head dazedly as for a moment two different views of the court fought for dominance in his mind, and then the illusions were blown away. Several courtiers fell back from the dead man in their midst. He had looked like just another courtier before, hidden by an unreal glamour, but now stood exposed as a grinning, rotting corpse. Its flesh was blackened and torn, revealing discolored bones and frayed strands of decaying muscle. Witchlight burned in its empty eye sockets. Then the lich realized it stood revealed for what it was. It struck out viciously at the nearest courtier. The man died instantly as the lich's bony fist buried itself in the side of his skull.
Damon!
Oi!
Damon Cord stepped toward the lich, but before he could get any further, the gleaming glass chandelier above the court started to shake. The shattered glass melted and changed into gore crows, all flying off in different directions. They swept back and forth over the courtiers' heads, their beaks and claws drawing blood from those who couldn't dodge fast enough. Behind the throne's raised dais, a man was melting into the far wall. Already it was hard to tell where his flesh ended and the stone began. He was horribly emaciated, his bones pressed out against the taut skin. His sunken eyes were alive and aware. He knew what was happening to him. Damon Cord ignored all that was happening. The crows, the melting man, the bedlam. He just locked eyes with the lich. He headed for the lich at a run. He reached out with his left hand and pulled a huge steel mace out of thin air. The thick shaft was 3 feet long, and the great club head was studded with wicked metal spikes. The vicious blows had torn the lich's head from its body, but it wasn't quite finished. The body convulsed and grabbed blindly for Cord with its clawed hands.
Just die! Good.
The last of the unreal life had gone from the creatures. Cord just looked around for another enemy. Everybody backed away from him, unnerved by the open savagery in his scarred face. The steward had deliberately left Cord to fight on his own. They both preferred to work alone. Taggart raised her hands toward the crows. Crackling white balefire appeared in front of her. She sent it soaring into the air. The soaring crows fell like meteors as soon as the balefire touched them. Even as the courtiers scattered to avoid the burning birds, the steward was already running down the hall toward the man trapped in the wall. She made a grasping motion with her right hand. A long, slender sword formed itself out of balefire and fitted itself into her clutching hand. At the same time, a glowing silvery shield appeared on her left arm. Cord glared balefully about him, and his gaze settled on a portly noble to Jordan's left. He smiled slowly and hefted his mace. Foulness dripped from the metal tines. The noble shook his head and began to back away.
No! Please! It's a mistake! I'm real! Real as you! Do I look like one of those things? Just look at me!
Cord moved steadily toward him. The noble backed away even faster, and the courtiers scattered to give them both plenty of room. The noble glanced around him and found he'd run out of room. There was nothing there but a wall. He looked at Cord, and his face went cold and dead.
Ah! Ah!
He grabbed a woman's arm and pulled her to him, holding her before him as a shield. His eyes were empty and lifeless.
Stay back, or I'll kill her!
The unreal man pulled a knife from its sleeve and set the edge against the woman's throat. A drop of blood slid slowly down her neck as the sharp edge nicked the skin.
Please!
She looked beseechingly at Cord. He smiled at her reassuringly and jabbed with his left arm. The mace flew from his hand. The knife fell harmlessly to the floor, and the creature's shattered arm hung limply at its side. Cord reached into thin air and pulled out a great two-edged broadsword. The noble's head flew through the air, but the body didn't fall. The hostage had fainted. A long split appeared in the noble's suddenly bare chest, stretching lengthwise and forming into a mouth that reached from neck to groin, lined with shining teeth. A long, leathery tongue shot out of the opening and wrapped itself around Cord, pinning his arms to his sides. His great muscles bulged as he tried to break free, but the tongue was too strong for him. It began to contract back into the body mouth, dragging Cord with it.
No!
Jordan stepped toward Cord's mace.
Damn, this thing is heavy!
He advanced cautiously on the unreal noble, hefting the mace as best he could. He knew the steward had said not to interfere, and given any choice, he would have been happy not to. But he couldn't just stand by and watch a man die. He moved forward as quietly as he could and sneaked up on the thing from behind. Without a head, the creature shouldn't be able to see or hear him, but he wasn't taking any chances he didn't have to. A second mouth appeared suddenly in the creature's back, lined with chomping teeth. It knew he was there. Jordan stopped dead in his tracks and switched the mace awkwardly to his left hand. He used the other hand to palm a fire pellet from his sleeve. The pellet flew right into the creature's mouth. Smoke poured from every opening, and the blazing light could be seen clearly through the creature's flesh.
I'm free! Step back, Prince!
The creature gradually fell apart into twitching pieces that took a long time to die and lie still. Jordan looked away and saw the severed head grinning up at him. It snarled silently. It finally stopped moving. He looked up, and Cord nodded to him approvingly. Jordan grinned back. Not all the birds had died from the steward's balefire. A dozen of them dived shrieking toward the regent, still standing beside the throne. Jordan started toward him to help, and then stopped as the Lady Gabrielle lifted her arm and pointed imperiously at the birds. They fell clumsily out of the air, their mouths opening and closing like fish out of water. Jordan frowned, confused, and on moving closer saw that the birds were gasping futilely for air. Of course, Gawain said she had air magic. She was drawing the air out of their lungs. He looked at Gabrielle with new respect. He made a note not to upset her. The steward skidded to a halt before the man melting into the wall, holding her sword of light high. Dark blood spurted from the broken stone. The wall heaved and convulsed around the emaciated body, and then formed into a jagged mouth that spat the body out. The man fell limply to the ground and lay still. He was little more than skin and bone. The wall had all but sucked him dry. The steward stood over him, her shimmering shield between them and the stone mouth. It grinned at her and stretched wider and wider until it was the length of the wall. Squat, bulky teeth appeared behind the thick, gross lips. The steward pressed the attack. The stone yielded helplessly to the glowing balefire, but the blade was too small to do any real damage to the gigantic mouth. The steward backed away a step, made a quick gesture with her hands, and her sword and shield disappeared. Jordan was about to ask what she was thinking when he realized that the wall was pursing its lips and smiling.
We are coming. We will be here soon. We are coming!
Not on my watch. Restore!
The wall rippled and buckled as she fought to destroy the force that had possessed the chamber. Her lips pursed in concentration, the huge mouth twisted in agony. There was a flare of light too bright to look at. And when everyone's eyes had cleared, The mouth was gone, and the wall was just a wall again. The steward knelt down beside the man she'd rescued and felt for a pulse in his neck. After a moment, she nodded tiredly and stood up again. She gestured to the nearest servants, and they hurried forward to take care of the shrunken figure. Jordan looked closely at the man as he was carried past, and was relieved to note that the emaciated chest was still rising and falling, if only just. He looked back at the steward to congratulate her, and then hesitated. She was clearly unsteady on her feet, and for the first time Jordan realized just how much her magic had taken out of her. Her face was pale and drawn, and sweat trickled down her brow. Her hands were shaking slightly, but when Damon Cord hurried over to stand at her side, she brusquely waved away his silent offer of support. She looked slowly around the quiet hall, taking in the silent courtiers and what remained of the dead, unreal creatures, and finally she nodded wearily. She turned to the throne on the dais and bowed to the regent.
That's it. I've done all I can here. But things are going to stay unsettled until there's a king on the throne again. My sorcerer is strong enough to cope for the moment, but that's all. Tell the people why we're here. We can't put this off any longer.
Is the hall clear of the unreal now?
The steward looked at the monk. Lewis stiffened slightly. For a moment, Jordan thought the steward was going to say something to Gabrielle, but then the moment passed, and she just looked away.
I've done all I can, my lady. Let the regent say his piece, and then we can all get out of here. I don't know about the rest of you, but I've got work to do.
Yeah, lots to be done.
He hefted the sword in his hand and grinned nastily. He opened his hand, and the sword suddenly disappeared. Jordan was startled as the mace in his hand disappeared too.
What the?
Shh, it's just what he does. Now hush, dear, the regent is about to speak.
My friends, as you have just seen, we live in dangerous times. Without a king on the throne, the whole of Redheart could soon fall prey to the unreal. But with the will, the crown, and the seal missing, we have been unable to declare any of the princes to be king. All three brothers have had ample time to find the crown and seal, and they have all failed. We cannot, we dare not wait any longer. It is therefore my unfortunate duty to proclaim the right of transference, as established in precedent. From this moment on, any man with blood who presents crown and seal to the stone in the correct ceremony will be declared the next king of Redheart.
For a long time, nobody said anything. The shocked silence just seemed to echo on and on. Jordan looked frantically at Gawain and Heather for some clue as to how he should be reacting, but they looked just as blank as everyone else. Jordan rummaged quickly through his memory, but couldn't recall anyone saying anything about a rite of transference. He looked across at Prince Dominic. The man's face was, if anything, even paler than before, but his icy calm hadn't wavered in the least. As Jordan watched, the Lady Elizabeth whispered urgently in Dominic's ear. He nodded absently, then turned to leave the hall. Jordan looked quickly over at Prince Louis, but he was already heading for the door too, followed by Ironheart and the monk. Jordan turned to Sir Gawain.
If they're going, I'd better go too. We've got to discuss this, and fast.
Indeed.
He and the Lady Heather walked beside Jordan as he stalked silently out of the court. Jordan hoped like hell that Count Roderick, Argent, and de Grange would be waiting for him in his quarters when he got there. He'd only been in this job a few hours, and already the scenario he'd been given was falling apart. What the hell was the rite of transference? Jordan ground his teeth together. This was all he needed. More bloody complications. He'd better get some advice, and quickly, or come the next morning, there could be a new king on the throne that none of the factions had counted on.
That devious bastard! He'll plunge us all into civil war before he's through.
Count Roderick stalked back and forth in Jordan's suite, waving his hands around as he fumed. Jordan leaned back against the mantelpiece and let him get on with it. Roderick hadn't stopped whining since he arrived, and Jordan was getting more than a little tired of it. After all, Roderick probably wouldn't have been half as angry if he hadn't had to babysit Victor while all the excitement was going on at court. Jordan looked surreptitiously at the others to see how they were taking it. Sir Gawain was standing at parade rest by the closed main door, his face showing a polite interest that wasn't mirrored in his eyes. Robert Argent was sitting slumped in a chair, gnawing at a thumbnail and scowling at nothing in particular. The Lady Heather was sitting on the arm of the chair Prince Victor was sitting in. They both looked more thoughtful than worried. Victor looked up irritably as Roderick drew near him.
Oh, do be quiet, Roderick. I'm trying to think. We're all upset, but we haven't the time to indulge in hysterics.
Roderick stopped dead in his tracks and glared at Victor.
Your Highness, may I point out that you are quite possibly only hours away from losing your throne and your position, to say nothing of your life. As things stand, anyone can just walk up to the stone with the crown and the seal and be made king on the spot.
Anyone with blood. That does rather limit the field. I agree things are somewhat desperate, but no more so now than they were a few hours ago. If my brothers and I and all our people haven't been able to find the crown and seal in all this time, I don't see how anyone else can hope to. No, our only real fear is that someone already has them hidden and has been waiting for this chance. Poor fool. Whoever it is, he won't get within 10 feet of the Great Hall. De Grange and his men are already guarding all the approach corridors, ostensibly to keep the peace, but actually under my direct orders to kill any pretender who appears. A nice touch, I thought, using De Grange. It gives the regent the illusion of security, while ensuring my interests remain covered.
I'm afraid it's not that simple, Your Highness. Your brother's men have also established themselves in the Great Hall, no doubt with similar orders. There have been a few skirmishes already.
Really? Who's winning?
No one's winning. We're all losing. While we waste time fighting among ourselves, the regent is sitting there laughing at us.
Don't shout at me, Roderick. I have a headache.
Roderick looked at Victor and seemed to remember where he was and at whom he was shouting. He bowed stiffly.
My apologies, sire.
That's better. Don't let it happen again, there's a good chap. Now then, I think we'd all benefit from a short break. Heather, hand around my pipes and tobacco. You know where they are. And there are drinks in the cabinet for those who'd like them.
Jordan shot a quick, guilty look at the drinks cabinet and tried to remember if he'd put the whiskey decanter back in the right place. Luckily, nobody seemed interested in a drink or the rack of long clay pipes that Heather passed around. Everyone was too tense to even think of relaxing. Jordan scowled briefly. He could have done with a stiff drink, but he didn't like to ask if nobody else was drinking. They all sat, or stood, in silence for a while, each of them lost in their own thoughts, and finding little pleasure or hope there.
I think I'm missing something. You all seem to be implying that the regent is risking civil war in Redheart for a reason. What reason? What could he hope to gain?
It's complicated. Basically, King Malcolm made Count William the regent because William is an honest man, possibly the most honest and honorable man at court. Unfortunately, because of his overly strict sense of morality, William has never approved of the present royal line. He certainly does not approve of the three princes who stand to inherit Malcolm's throne. By William's lights, none of them are worthy of it. So, by declaring the right of transference, he is hoping a new royal line will emerge to sit on the throne and replace the existing one. That new line would, of course, be heavily dependent on the regent when it came to actually running the country.
Just what is this right of transference? I mean, what exactly does it do? And while we're on the subject, why haven't I been told about it before?
Because it hasn't been used in 300 years. The last time it was declared, it was used to establish the present royal line after extensive inbreeding had made the old line worthless. I'd forgotten the damn thing was still on the law books.
All right, so it's legal. But can the regent back it up? Does he have the troops? And would the court stand for it? I mean, their interests are tied in with the prince's, aren't they?
Not necessarily, actor. The aristocracy is based on blood, and as things stand, anyone with blood could use the crown and seal to make themselves king. As far as the court is concerned, this is a once-in-a-lifetime chance to ascend to the throne. Not that it'll happen that way, of course.
Wait, why not?
Because neither I nor my brothers will stand for it. That's why not. As you pointed out, in the end it all comes down to force of arms. The regent commands the castle guards, but as princes, we each have our own private troops. More than enough to take the crown and seal away from whoever has them.
You're talking about waging a war in your own country. Not just against the regent, but against your brothers as well. How many of your people would die in those wars? Not just your guards and men-at-arms, how many peasants and townspeople, how many farmers and merchants, how many men, women, and children would have to die to make you king? Hundreds? Thousands?
At least. It isn't important. It is my right to be king. And it is the duty of all my subjects to fight, and if need be, die for their king.
I'm not sure raising an army would prove all that easy, Your Highness. With so many questions still unanswered over King Malcolm's death, nobody trusts anybody anymore. The way things are, neither you nor your brothers can be as sure of support as you once could.
No one can blame me. I was in exile when the old man died.
Yes, sire, you were, but you could have ordered it done.
Look, it seems to me that we're worrying too much about things that haven't happened and might never happen. If we worry about every little thing that could go wrong, we'll never get anything done. Let's stick to things that actually matter. For example, how was my performance? Nobody said a thing about it yet. Was I convincing?
Do I need to work on the voice more?
Trust an actor to care only about his reviews.
You did very well, sire. You were Prince Victor to the life. And stepping in to help Daemon Cord against the Unreal was a good move. It never hurts to be conspicuously brave in front of the right people. It might even draw us some popular support at court later on.
Yes. Well, that as may be. In the meantime, we'll let you know if your work's not up to standard, actor. I've done enough for one evening. My head hurts. I'm going back to my quarters.
Not yet, Your Highness. We still have the other glamour spell to do.
What? Another glamour spell? No one said anything to me about another glamour spell.
It's just a little something to help you in your performance as Victor. You've done very well so far, considering, but whilst you look and sound very much like Prince Victor, you still wouldn't convince anyone who knew the prince well. It's not your fault. You haven't had a chance to meet His Highness in person before now, so you haven't been able to acquire all the little mannerisms, phrases of speech and so on, that help to make up his private and public faces. This new glamour spell will graft these things directly onto your memory, much as the first spell gave you Victor's appearance. That's really all there is to it.
Jordan thought about it. There was something about this new spell that disturbed him very deeply. The first spell had simply altered his outer appearance. That hadn't been so bad once you get used to it. Actors did it all the time with costumes, wigs, and makeup. But this new spell would change the way he spoke and moved, perhaps even the way he thought, and yet he couldn't say no. They were right. There wasn't time to learn the part by observation. He had to be perfect straight away. And this was the only way.
All right. Let's do it.
Excellent. Have a seat.
Jordan's palms were wet with sweat, and he rubbed them unobtrusively against the chair arms to dry them. The prince was sitting up straight in his chair, despite his obvious tiredness. He didn't even look worried, the smug bastard. The Lady Heather looked at Jordan as if he was some interesting exhibit in a private zoo. He tried to settle himself more comfortably in his chair, but each position seemed worse than the last. It was all in his mind, he knew that, but it didn't help his nerves at all. He hated to be kept waiting. Robert Argent was watching him closely, and Jordan kept his expression carefully calm. He glanced across at Sir Gawain, hoping for a little moral support, but the knight had turned his face away, as if he couldn't bear to watch what was about to happen. Jordan began to regulate his breathing, keeping it slow and steady, and set about calming his nerves, as he had so often before, standing in the wings of a stage, waiting to go out on the boards and do what he was born to do. His composure slowly came back to him, and his muscles began to relax in ones and twos. He was the great Jordan. He could handle this. Roderick looked at him, and then at the prince. He nodded, satisfied.
Cleptu argenso lacti ipsum. Via nu corpus duex.
He raised his left hand and gestured sharply. Night fell. There was no light, and the darkness was everywhere. Jordan discovered he couldn't hear or feel anything either, and fought down a brief surge of panic. He clenched his hands into fists, but he couldn't feel the chair arms they rested on, or even the pressure of the fingers against each other. The darkness swirled about him in a slow, steady rhythm, and his panic slowly ebbed away. There was nothing disturbing about the dark. In fact, it was almost restful, like lying in bed at night with your eyes closed. He waited patiently. Something came into the darkness with him, and without knowing how or why, he knew it was Victor. They drifted closer to each other, and then their minds touched.
You stole her from me! She was mine, and you stole her!
I'll give you one chance to take that back, or I'll kill you where you stand.
Of course, Your Excellency. I will go of my own accord. But I will return.
Go away.
What's keeping you? There should be nothing more important than what I need. Need.
The garden was full of flowers. Their rich and heady scent filled the air now that the rain had finally stopped. He picked a rose, and the thorn pricked his thumb. The drop of blood it drew was the same color as the rose. He rode across the empty moor as twilight fell, his horse plunging beneath him, a good length and more in front of his nearest rival. The cold wind blew tears from his eyes. Thick, smoky air diffused the lantern light into a dim amber glow in the back alley tavern. He knew he shouldn't be there on his own, in the worst part of Kahalimar, but he didn't care. He had his hands around Dominic's throat, and he was crying as he tried to murder his brother. Elizabeth watched them struggle, and there was nothing in her face but an endless, weary contempt. Past and present rolled into a single kaleidoscopic mosaic that battered at Jordan's mind in overwhelming detail. He swayed and shuddered under the assault, but still clung stubbornly to his own sense of identity. Years of pretending to be people other than himself had given his mind a strength and resilience beyond the norm, and even as Victor's memories strove to convert him into a duplicate of themselves, Jordan was already fighting back. He had to. His mind, his soul, everything that made him unique was in danger of being supplanted by the other man's memories. He clung fiercely to what was his, and slowly, gradually, the pressure faded. He began to pick and choose among the endless stream of information that flowed to him from Victor, taking only what he needed. How to move, how to talk, how to seem like Victor without actually being him. And still the memories came and went. Jordan moved among them at his leisure, searching for anything that looked useful or interesting. He came across something strange, and Victor tried to pull back, to hide the memory from him. Jordan took control easily and looked closely at what Victor hadn't wanted him to see. Victor lay on his back in bed with Heather snuggled up against him. He stared up at the ceiling, his eyes idly following a long, wavering crack in the plaster.
Victor?
Yes?
Do you really think there's going to be a civil war?
Bound to be. Too many factions and none of them willing to compromise. Best way in the long run. I wouldn't feel safe as long as my brothers or the Regent were still alive.
I can see that, Victor. But if there is a civil war, thousands of people could die.
Probably. It doesn't matter. They're only peasants, after all. Breed like rabbits. Don't go all squeamish on me now, Heather. I'm going to need your strength. I learned my lesson during those long years in exile. Look out for yourself first, and everyone else second, if at all. I don't give a damn for the peasants or the courtiers or anyone else in this stinking country. None of them lifted a finger to help me when I needed help. To hell with them all!
Jordan recoiled in horror. He thought he was prepared for almost anything, but the depth of contempt that Victor had for his subjects shocked Jordan profoundly. The prince used that moment to pull free.
Victor, wait!
Heather, give him some water! Now!
Roderick, if he's hurt!
Get him water, Heather.
Jordan's eyes ached, and he knuckled them as best he could with his shaking hands. Already much of what he'd learned was slipping away below the conscious level, but he clung grimly to what was important. He looked coldly at Prince Victor, sitting slumped in his chair. He didn't know why he'd been so shocked at what he'd found in Victor's mind. There was no law that said a king had to love his people, and compared to his brothers, Victor was almost a saint. Perhaps it was just that Jordan was disappointed in Victor. He'd hoped for better in the man he was to portray.
I was right. I am playing a villain.
Actor! Drink this, it'll help.
What is it?
Brandy.
Oh, thank you.
Robert, help me carry Victor.
All right. Here. That's good. Now on three.
Wait!
What?
He needs a drink. Here you are. Just drink up, Victor. It's all right. I'm here. There you are. Just have a sip. Good boy. We're going to take you back to your bed now.
Now lift, Robert.
Roderick and Argent half led, half carried Victor out of the room. The prince's face was slack and dazed. Roderick and Argent paused just long enough for Heather to pull Victor's cowl forward so that it hid his face. Then they hustled the prince out into the corridor. Heather hurried after them. Jordan was left alone in the room with Sir Gawain. He held out his empty glass.
Don't stop there, Gawain. Thanks. And have some for yourself. How's Victor?
He'll recover. You're looking better, sire.
I've felt worse. I take it no one expected this strong a reaction to the spell.
Right. Sometimes I think Roderick doesn't know half as much about sorcery as he claims. If I'd known the spell would be this dangerous to the prince, I'd never have allowed him to use it. Still, it's done now. Did you learn anything useful?
Yes, I learned a few things.
Gawain waited a moment until it became clear the actor wasn't going to say any more. He looked thoughtfully at Jordan.
Seeing as you're well on the road to recovery, sire, I'd better go and see how Victor's doing. If I were you, I'd get some sleep. Tomorrow's liable to be a very busy day. You'll be quite safe here. This suite is protected by strong magical wards. And the two guards outside will keep anyone from disturbing your rest.
Before you go, perhaps you'd answer a question for me.
If I can, sire.
Why hasn't Roderick put a geas on me like he did de Grange? That way he could be sure of controlling me.
I'm sure the idea occurred to him, sire, but a geas would have been far too conspicuous. Any number of people here would have recognized it for what it was. Is there anything else, sire, before I go?
Oh, yeah. What about the dog?
What dog, sire?
Victor's dog. The one he keeps in his bedroom. What am I supposed to feed it on?
I think you must be mistaken. Victor doesn't have a dog. He can't stand the creatures.
Well, look for yourself. It's right there in the bedroom.
Is that so? There's no dog there now, Your Highness. Perhaps a stray got in here somehow. There are enough of them around the castle. They help keep the rats down. I shouldn't worry about it. Good night, Your Highness. Pleasant dreams.
He bowed formally and left.
No dog.
Jordan looked in puzzlement at the closed bedroom door. He was proud to note that his legs were only slightly unsteady now.
Empty.
He shrugged and wandered into the bedroom. He sat down on the edge of the bed and ran his hand caressingly over the luxurious eiderdown. It had been a long, hard day, and he had enough things to worry about without brooding over some vanishing dog. He pulled off his boots and wriggled his grateful toes. The bed felt wonderfully soft and comfortable. If nothing else, at least while he was at the castle, he should be able to get a good night's sleep. Prince Victor sat listlessly on the edge of his bed, his head bowed forward and his eyes half closed. The Lady Heather unbuttoned his shirt with gentle efficiency and pulled it back off his arms. His torso was gaunt to the point of emaciation, and the skin was deathly pale. Heather forced herself not to pay it any attention. Victor knew how ill he looked, but he couldn't bear seeing the knowledge of it in her eyes. She made herself concentrate on the simple business of getting Victor out of his clothes and into his nightshirt. At first he'd refused to wear one, claiming it was an old man's garment, but as he became weaker, he quickly found the nights too cold without one. He was so feeble now he couldn't even undress himself, and it was that simple helplessness that infuriated him the most. Finally, Heather had him ready for bed, and she turned away to the nearby medicine table. Vials and bottles of all shapes and sizes clustered together in an untidy mess, the various liquids, powders, and roots making a dull rainbow of colors. Victor had tried them all at one time or another.
Here we are.
Not crawling to 10.
What was that, darling?
Nothing. Just an idea as to where that muck probably comes from. Are you sure I'm not supposed to rub it on instead of drinking it?
You really are a baby when it comes to taking your medicine, Victor.
Oh, shut up or I'll hit you with my rattle.
Sooner or later, we're bound to find one that helps, my dear. If only by the law of averages. Now, are we going to do this the easy way, or am I going to have to hold your nose again?
Heather made herself keep smiling. It tore at her heart to see him so down and defenseless. She brought the spoon carefully over to Victor's mouth.
Oh, that tastes so vile, it must be doing me good. Well, where's my sweetie? A good nurse always has a nice sweetie for afterward to take the nasty taste away.
All right, then.
Sorry, love. The spirit is willing, but it's not in charge anymore. I'm tired. I'm always tired these days.
Heather smiled comfortingly and nodded. She didn't dare say anything for fear her voice would betray her. She carefully recorked the bottle and put it and the spoon back on the table.
All right. Now let's get you under the covers.
She leaned forward, took firm hold of his legs, and lifted them up onto the bed. He leaned backward, and she helped lower him the rest of the way. She pulled the heavy covers up over him, and his head sank exhaustedly back into the pillow. Heather let her hand rest on his forehead for a moment. His skin was hot and dry to the touch.
Oh, I never thought I'd die this way. A battle that went wrong or a dagger in the back, that was something I'd grown used to. I could cope with that. But dying in bed by inches? I'm scared, Heather.
Don't be, my love. I'm here.
I'm tired, Heather. Very tired. I think I'll sleep for a while. Are the guards and wards in place?
Yes, darling. Don't you worry about anything. You're perfectly safe here. Rest easy.
She straightened up and saw that his eyes were already closed and his face was slack. She stood by the bed for a while, watching his shallow breathing. Then she turned and tiptoed out of the bedchamber. Her shoulders slumped. Being constantly cheerful and encouraging was hard work. She leaned back against the closed door with her eyes shut, gathering her strength. The Lady Emma Hellstrom looked up from her sewing and smiled at her.
Heather, my dear, you look tired enough to drop. Come over here and sit with me before you fall down.
Heather opened her eyes and smiled at Emma and pushed herself away from the door.
He's settled now. I think he'll sleep for a while. I hope so, anyway.
Still no improvement?
Worse, if anything. I've tried him on every medicine the surgeons have come up with, and none of them have made a blind bit of difference. He's so weak now, he can't even walk unaided. Oh, Emma, it breaks my heart to see him this way.
The Lady Emma patted Heather comfortingly on the arm as she sat down beside her.
You must be strong, my dear. You'll have to be strong enough for both of you.
I know, Emma. You think he's going to die, don't you?
Yes, I'm afraid so.
He's not going to die. I won't let him. I swear if I ever get my hands on the bastards who've done this to him.
You still think it's poison?
It has to be.
I don't see how it can be, Heather. I mean, Argent tastes everything before Victor even touches it.
I know. Whoever it is, they've been very clever. When I find out who's responsible, I'll see to it that he dies by inches.
I'll help hold him down.
I'd like that, Emma.
When they'd first met, Heather had wondered what Sir Gawain had ever seen in his wife. The Lady Emma was a plump, mousy woman in her early 40s, Whatever beauty she might once have had in her youth had faded away into plain, unremarkable features and a more than comfortably padded body. At first, Heather had seen her as just another victim for her wit, someone else to take out the day's frustrations on. But right from the beginning, Emma had made a point of answering Heather in kind, and the two women quickly developed a surprisingly strong attachment for each other. As Victor and Gawain spent most of their time together, it was hardly surprising that Heather and Emma found themselves often in each other's company, and their early friendship had long since hardened into an unbreakable bond.
Tell me, have you seen Victor's double yet? What's he like?
Physically, he's so like Victor, it's frightening. He even sounds like him, or at least like Victor before Victor fell ill. But I don't like him. He's an arrogant sort, like all actors, full of himself and forgetful of his proper place. But he'll do the job well enough. And afterwards...
My dear Heather, if you followed through on every one of your dire threats, we'd have to build another cemetery. You can't kill everyone you don't like, or soon we'd have no one left to talk to.
I'm right this time, Emma, and you know it. The actor has to die. We can't risk his telling anyone about his part in our little conspiracy, can we? It's not as if he was the only one marked for death. Once Victor is king, he can't allow anyone in a position of power to have undue influence over him. Argent is a tradesman. We can bargain with him. But Roderick... he forgets his place too often, the nasty little man. Just because he has some blood, he thinks he's as good as my Victor. Sometimes he even seems to think that he's in charge of this conspiracy, and Victor is only there to follow his orders. We can't have that, can we? No. Once my Victor is safely on the throne, there are going to be quite a few surprised faces at court.
The chuckling was at odds with the looks of grim anticipation in their faces.
Come on.
Prince Louis stood outside his brother Dominic's door, waiting impatiently for a reply, and tugged surreptitiously at the chainmail vest hidden under his jerkin. His guards had sealed off the corridor at both ends, but he still felt uneasy. Ironheart stood motionless in the middle of the corridor, his armor gleaming dully in the torchlight. If anyone did get past the guards, they'd still have to face him. And there was always the monk. He stood silently at Louis's side, a gray, baleful presence that was still somehow comforting. If you had to enter the lion's den, the best protection was to take something with you that was even more dangerous than the lion. Louis shuffled his feet restlessly and wondered whether to knock again in case they hadn't heard him. Though he wouldn't admit it to anyone, Louis was dying to see what Dominic's new quarters were like. No one except Dominic's own people were ever allowed inside, and none of them would talk about it. They couldn't. Dominic had put a gias on them. Louis stepped forward into the antechamber, carefully keeping both his face and his posture very calm and assured. In dealing with Dominic, it was important to appear confident at all times. He looked around to see who had opened the door for him, but there was no one there. The monk followed right behind him. Louis looked casually about him and frowned. Dominic's antechamber was bare and austere. The only furniture, three straight-backed chairs set out on the bare stone floor. The bleak whitewashed walls were spotlessly clean and subtly depressing. This wasn't a room where people lived. It was just a room where people waited, while Dominic decided whether or not to see them. Louis moved over to the nearest chair, flicked imaginary dust off the seat with his handkerchief, and sat down. The monk took up a watchful stance beside him. Louis looked around sharply as Dominic and Elizabeth came in through a door he would have sworn wasn't there a moment ago. They stood alone by the door, and Louis stiffened slightly as he realized that Dominic hadn't brought any troops to guard him. Either he didn't see his brother as much of a threat, or he was confident in his own sorcery to protect him. Dominic bowed briefly to Louis, and he nodded curtly in return. He didn't get up from his chair, but they didn't seem to notice. They each walked to an empty chair.
Well, this is very pleasant, isn't it? Must be all of 4 years since you and I last sat down to talk together, Dominic.
That's right. Dear Victor had just been banished from court,
and you and I were discussing how best to turn that to our advantage. You proposed a partnership, as I recall, but nothing came of it. We didn't trust each other. We knew each other too well, perhaps. Do you feel things have changed since then, Lewis?
Probably not. But we do have things to discuss. The Regent has just made a difficult situation suddenly even more difficult with the right of transference. Interfering bastard. I should have had him killed a long time ago. He's always been too honest for our good. We've got to find the crown and seal quickly, Dominic. Since I don't have them, and my spies assure me that you don't have them, it seems to me the odds are very much in favor of Victor having them. There must be some good reason why he hasn't used them yet, but now that the situation has changed so drastically, he could try for the stone at any time. We'll have to take the crown and seal from him, and neither of us is strong enough to do that on our own. De Grange's guards are all over the place, and Victor's fire magic is as strong as ever. You saw what he did at court.
Yes, it was most impressive. But what makes you so sure Victor has the crown and seal?
Process of elimination. Outside of the three of us, who is there? A few nobodies who fancy themselves as kings or kingmakers. My spies have kept a close watch on all of them. On the other hand, something is definitely happening with Victor and his people. I haven't been able to find out what. They're too well shielded. But whatever it is, it's important. So important, they've killed all of my people who even looked as though they might be getting near the truth.
You're quite right. There is something going on. But they don't have the crown or the seal. They're as baffled as we are.
Lewis looked at her thoughtfully. She was smiling too much, the cold, calculating smile of someone who knows something you don't. On the other hand, that wasn't exactly unusual where Elizabeth was concerned.
Just how sure are you of your information? Last I heard, your people had been having the same problems as mine. Or have you and Victor been getting acquainted again now that he's back?
Hardly. No, my dear Lewis, it's much simpler than that. We have a spy in their inner circle, a traitor. Would you like to meet him?
Lewis fought to keep his face calm and undisturbed. If Dominic really did have a traitor in Victor's camp, he had an advantage Lewis couldn't hope to match. How the hell had Dominic managed it? Lewis had tried everything from outrageous bribes to open death threats without any effect at all. He would have sworn that all of Victor's people were under Aegeus. They were so sickeningly loyal. Either that, or they didn't know anything good enough to be worth selling. He realized Dominic and Elizabeth were still looking at him inquiringly. Did he want to see the traitor? Well, they knew damn well he couldn't afford to say no.
Yes. Show me your traitor.
Of course. He's waiting in my quarters. I thought you might like to take a look at my private chambers while you're here. I designed them myself, and I'm rather proud of the way they've come out. This way.
Lewis was on guard. There had to be a catch in this somewhere. They were just baiting him for the fun of it. If the traitor's identity had any real value, they'd never have mentioned his existence, let alone offer a chance to meet him. Dominic turned to the inner door and waved a hand. He offered Elizabeth his arm, and the two of them walked unhurriedly through the doorway. Lewis jerked his head at the monk and hurried after them, barely able to contain his curiosity. The monk followed him. Lewis wished for a moment that the monk would make some noise when he moved, or at least show a foot. The sorcerer just slid along the floor, his long robe flapping slightly as he moved. Dominic and Elizabeth stood to one side as Lewis and the monk entered the main room, and Lewis couldn't help it.
Oh, damn.
He was staggered by what he saw. All of the intervening walls in Dominic's suite had been removed, turning it into one gigantic chamber. Lewis hated to think how many spells Dominic must be maintaining just to keep the ceiling from collapsing. The outer walls had been painted varying shades of blue and green that shifted subtly as he watched, suggesting the endless tides and swells of the ocean. The air was pleasantly moist, but the carpeted floor showed no signs of damp or rot. The scattered rugs and hangings were a depressingly bitter shade of green. Lewis supposed they were meant to represent seaweed. They were ugly enough. The delicate filigreed furniture seemed out of place in the grotesque setting. Lewis walked slowly forward, drawing strength from the silent figure of the monk at his side. The listening wall to his left swirled and heaved constantly, and Lewis suddenly realized he was looking at a vast expanse of water. He thought at first it must be contained behind a wall of strengthened glass. But when he moved over and reached out a hesitant hand to touch it, his finger slid unimpeded into the icy water. There was no wall. Only Dominic's sorcery held the water in place.
This? Is that?
Lewis stared deep into the water and saw something move within. He watched, open-mouthed, as a huge shark, easily 30 feet long, came surging out of the distance toward him, growing larger and larger as he watched. He snatched his hand out of the water and fell back a step. For one horrible moment, he thought the shark was going to burst out of the water after him. But at the last second, it turned aside and swam along the length of the wall. Lewis's belly tightened as the shark's flat black eye rolled slowly in its smooth gray head, watching him. It knew he was there. Its teeth were a ragged row in a mouth that had never known a smile, and in its cold, dead eye, there was all the hunger in the world. The shark flicked its tail suddenly and was gone, gliding back into the immeasurable depths beyond the wall of water. How far back does the water go? Thought Lewis dazedly. What the hell has Dominic done here?
One of my pets.
Very impressive. I never knew you were fond of fishing.
Dominic smiled, and Lewis felt something cold move within him. For a moment, Dominic's eyes had looked just like the shark's.
I promised you an audience with my spy, and here he is.
A man wrapped in a dark cloak appeared suddenly out of thin air to stand beside Dominic. Lewis stepped back and flushed hotly. He didn't take kindly to being made the butt of someone else's humor. His hand dropped toward his sword hilt, but stopped a few inches short. He was in Dominic's territory now, and he dare not risk an open attack, even with the monk at his side. On his own ground, Dominic was too well protected by his sorcery, not to mention his blood. Lewis turned his attention to the spy, and his stomach lurched. The man had no face. The eyelids were sealed seamlessly shut, and below the blind eyes there was only a blank expanse of smooth skin, and no trace of mouth or nose. He stood very still, awaiting Dominic's orders.
This isn't how he usually looks, but I'm not quite ready to trust you with his identity yet. That will require a great deal more commitment on both our parts than I think we're ready to give. But I assure you, he is one of Victor's inner circle, trusted by everyone and privy to all their secrets. Aren't you, my dear traitor?
A flat mouth opened in the blank face like a wound.
Yes, Prince Dominic.
No offense, Dominic, but how do I know this person really is who you say he is? He could be anyone.
No offense taken, dear brother. I brought him here to tell you things. Things only an inner confidant could know. Tell him, traitor.
Victor is ill and has been for some time. He is being slowly poisoned and is growing steadily weaker despite everything his supporters can do. Of late, he is unable to leave his chambers without help.
He seemed strong enough this evening in court.
There is reason for that, but I don't think I'll share that with you just yet. I have to keep some secrets to myself.
All right. I'll accept the spy as genuine. I'd heard about Victor's illness from my own confidential source. But can you trust this spy? Traitors are notoriously unreliable.
He obeys my every whim. Traitor, put your hand in the water and leave it there.
The faceless man thrust his hand into the water up to the wrist. He stood there unmoving, and Lewis's hackles rose sharply as he realized what was going to happen. Even as the thought crossed his mind, the dark shadow of the shark appeared in the distance. It moved rapidly forward, jaws agape for the tasty morsel of flesh that hung unmoving in the water before it. The faceless man didn't move an inch. At the last moment, Dominic gestured sharply. The shark's jaws snapped together a fraction of a second later, and it turned sharply aside. It swam back and forth for a while, and then disappeared back into the depths. The faceless man moved back to stand beside Dominic, who patted him lightly on the arm, as a man might reward a dog that had performed some simple but amusing trick. Lewis's breathing began to return to normal. He didn't give a damn whether the traitor lived or died, but the inhuman control it must have taken for him to just stand there while the shark approached. A sudden thought came to Lewis, and he looked sharply at his brother.
This spy of yours, is he unreal?
Yes and no. Really, Lewis, you can't expect me to tell you all my secrets. Do I ask you about the monk? All you need to know is that my spy belongs to me, body and soul. He will do anything I require of him, anything at all. Now then, Lewis, I think we've finally come to the crux of your visit. You have come here, not for the first time, to propose an alliance between us, against a common enemy. To be honest, I don't see that anything has changed since your last visit. We both want the same thing, and neither of us is likely to step aside for the other.
Even so, we still have common cause for the moment. If we can't get to the stone, we can at least work together to make sure no one else can. There'll be time to worry about each other once we've taken care of the competition.
I think you overestimate the strength of your position. To put it bluntly, dear Lewis, you don't have anything I need. My support among the Blood is far greater than yours. My troops are well-armed and well-trained, and I have my own spy in Victor's Inner Circle. You have the monk, admittedly, but I have my own magic, and frankly, I think I trust that more than I'll ever trust the monk. Particularly after that debacle of his at Boromir. Releasing bloody bones from his grave wasn't really a very sensible thing to do, Lewis. I think that's all I have to say to you. You can go now.
Elizabeth smiled sweetly at Lewis and took Dominic's arm. They started to turn away. Lewis flushed hotly as he realized he'd just been dismissed as casually as any servant.
You never intended to go into partnership with me, did you, Dominic?
No.
Dominic stopped and looked back.
In fact, if it weren't for the monk and Ironheart, Lewis, you wouldn't even be in the game any longer. As it is, you're merely a nuisance.
Then why did you agree to see me?
You're a bright boy. You'll work it out.
Lewis's hand dropped to his sword hilt.
Ironheart!
He turned back to the door for a moment, nodding to the monk. When he turned back to curse his brother, Dominic, Elizabeth, and the faceless man had vanished without a trace.
Damn it!
The narrow passage was full of struggling men, and the air rang to the clash of swords on armor. A crowd of guards wearing Dominic's livery swarmed around Ironheart, trying to drag him down by sheer force of numbers. More guards lay dead and dying all around him. Ironheart moved slowly but remorselessly through his attackers, his sword still sheathed on his back, perhaps because there wasn't room to use it in the press of bodies, or possibly just because he preferred killing with his hands. His great mailed gauntlets swept back and forth, leaving a bloody trail of dying and crippled men in their wake. Flesh and bone tore and shattered under his inhuman strength, while swords and axes rang harmlessly from his armor. The guards fought like madmen, often scrambling over the bodies of their dead fellows to reach him, but all to no avail. He moved steadily forward, shaking off their clinging arms and slaughtering all those who came within reach of his blood-spattered fists.
Damn you all!
Another guard turned to face him, and Lewis's sword flashed out to sink deep into his gut. Lewis tore out his sword in a flurry of gore. The smell of blood hung heavily in the air, and Lewis grinned like a wolf as his sword rose and fell. Ironheart thrust his fist clean through a guard's chest, and the bloody knuckles protruded from the man's back. He died with a look of disbelief still on his face. One guard's axe punched through Ironheart's armor and buried itself in his ribs. As he lurched to a sudden halt, another guard seized his chance and thrust his sword through one of the eye holes in Ironheart's helm. The point of the sword jarred to a sudden halt against the back of the helmet. The guard soon realized that Ironheart wasn't falling. The two who had struck him died before they could fall out of range. He reached up and pulled the sword out of his visor. He left the axe hanging from his side and turned to the remaining guards. They broke and ran back down the corridor, leaving their dead and wounded behind them. The last man to go struck out at the monk in passing as a final gesture of defiance. The sword didn't even come close. The monk gestured briefly with an empty sleeve. The other guards only tried to distance themselves from the poor soul. His flesh boiled and ran away like wax from a candle flame. The light from his fire cast strange shadows on the antechamber walls, and the room soon filled with the scent of barbecue.
Well, that was somewhat expected, to be honest. He really wanted us all dead. Ironheart, Take that axe out of yourself. It's distracting. Now report. What's been happening while I was with Dominic?
Your brother's men were waiting for us. This was a carefully planned ambush, and we walked right into it. The guards you set to watch this corridor are dead. They were attacked the moment the antechamber door closed behind you. It seems likely that your brother has arranged further attacks on your men in your absence. I recommend we return to your quarters immediately and see what can be done to protect your position.
I agree. For the moment, my magic protects us from sorceress attacks, but the rest of your people are unprotected.
I should have known. I'll bet this was Elizabeth's idea originally. Rotten little bitch. No wonder she hardly said a word while I was there. She just sat there, smirking at me, knowing that all the time I was talking to Dominic about cooperation and partnerships, my men were being butchered at his command. I'll have their heart's blood for this. Monk, I want a full defensive screen over the three of us, and over as many of my people as you can cover.
That will leave me unable to mount any sorceress offensives.
I know. There's no point in attacking Dominic on his own ground. He's had all the time he needed to set up his own defenses. All we can do now is get the hell out of here and salvage what we can. Damn them. I'll have Dominic's head for this. And Elizabeth's. I'll stick their heads on the railings outside the main gates and the ravens can eat their eyes. If my magic wasn't just earth magic.
His voice dried up as he came again to his old familiar frustration. Out on the moors, or in the countryside, his blood magic made him stronger than either of his brothers. But as long as they remained inside the castle, Lewis's magic was practically useless. And Victor and Dominic had always been very careful never to be caught outside the castle at the same time as Lewis. He controlled his anger with difficulty and thought hard. There had to be something he could do to avenge this outrage. But he couldn't think of anything. He stalked off down the corridor. Ironheart and the monk followed, a short way behind. Lewis's fury began to settle into a cold, calculating anger. When all was said and done, he had more gold and jewels than Dominic and Victor put together. He'd always been the thrifty one in the family. Dominic might have cost him some men with this night's treachery, but there were always mercenaries ready to be hired. If he could get word to them in time, Lewis scowled determinedly. The game wasn't over yet. The real game was only just beginning.
Blood and Honor is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 1993, Simon R. Green, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2010, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terence Hazelford, David Coyne, Andy Clemens, Richard Rowan, Elizabeth Jernigan, Nanette Savard, Michael John Casey, Katie Foster, Peter Stray, Eric Messner, James Konacek, Michael Glenn, Danny Gavigan, Scott McCormick, Christopher Graybill, Yasmin Toison, Tim Getman, Colleen Delaney, and Mort Shelby. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Terence Hazelford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Book adapted for graphic audio by Dan Sondak. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Nathaniel Perry. The Forest Kingdom Saga theme was composed by Dan Sondak. Additional original music by Johann Detweiler, Nathaniel Perry, and Dan Sondak. If you enjoyed Blood and Honor, be sure to look for R.A. Salvatore's Demon Wars Saga, available at road stops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for previews of other thrilling titles in Graphic Audio.
Do you know your name?
Gailara Vada.
And do you know where you are?
You're the mercenaries.
Yes.
When can I get back to my ship?
After the Major talks to you, probably.
Captain Vada, we have a problem. We need a place to stash some neutral civilians. Your ship is more than adequate for that task.
Have you ever been in charge of a refugee situation?
No. You have suggestions?
The captains of the other Civ ships are going to think they should be running this. You have to convince them otherwise.
We want to talk to you.
This is ridiculous!
Unbelievable!
You get us killed!
Come on!
You're exceeding your authority!
This is a cargo hold!
Enough! I'm lucky to be alive, and so are you. Don't push your luck!
You know, from inside those cargo holds, they don't have far to go to access the linkages with hardware.
If they wanted to mess us up, they could.
I was afraid of that.
Drive just came on, Captain. Full boost. I can't get it off.
And I can't get anywhere with the nav board.
It's time to let more experienced officers take over.
Don't do it, Kai!
Gary?
Don't let him get the ship!
Let him go.
Hand us your captain's wallet. Then we'll see.
Vata's War. Book 1. Trading in Danger. Part 2. In graphic audio. If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.